CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here's your host, Katie Comley.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, a new study has found that the Metrotown SkyTrain station has been stretched to the limit. An international manhunt for a notorious BC pedophile has finally come to an end. And on commentary, Phil Caudry will be reflecting on the end of the Vancouver strike with librarians getting back to work. And he will also be discussing the future environment for labor negotiations in BC. We'll have all this, plus arts, sports, and your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next hour right here on News 101. But first, for a look at what's happening in the campus community, we turn to our correspondents from Radio Free UBC.
This week on Radio Free UBC, this is A War of Peace, a review of Udi Dekel, general for the Israeli Defense Army's talk at UBC, and a profile of What is Women Week, a talk with Dalian Rin of the Feminist Collective. Also, a controversy in the Faculty of Law. Mariana talks with Marianne Bovinsky, Dean of the Faculty of Law at UBC.
Today, the UBC Israel Awareness Club, a group affiliated with Campus Hillel, hosted a speaker at Thea Lounge. On their website, the Israel Awareness Club states that, quote, "Because the conflict in the Middle East provokes passionate feelings on all sides, the IAC strives to provide a forum in which constructive conversation can be fostered. Welcoming a diversity of opinions, IAC members hold a wide range of perspectives and approaches to the conflict. Nevertheless, the IAC is united by a belief in the right of Israel to exist as a Jewish state within secure borders. The club furthermore upholds the principles of freedom and democracy for which Israel stands." End quote. So, of course, who better to represent the, quote, "principles of freedom and democracy for which Israel stands" than Udi Dekel, a brigadier general at the notorious Israeli Defense Force, a force frequently accused of war crimes and overall death-squad-like behavior. Some audience members critical of the IDF distributed kazoos, which were buzzed whenever the general used the word terror. Now, ignoring for a moment that militaries in general are not famed for their willingness to engage in constructive conversation, General Dekel spoke about how the Israeli Defense Force is looking for new strategies to promote peace. But this lame PR attempt to justify insouciant slaughter of Palestinians and the entire decimation of a nation was challenged by some in the audience.
Bahram, a student at UBC, asked why the general is willing to label the actions of others as terrorism, but does not recognize that its own military actions are a form of terrorism as well. To which the general replied, "It is not a war of terror, it is a war of peace." Furthermore, an International Red Cross paramedic asked why the IDF bombed a power station in the Gaza Strip and why they are holding the economy hostage. To which the general replied, "We supply electricity, water, infrastructure. Who else would do that?" To which she replied, "We are not ignorant. Why do you presume that we are?" She then went on to highlight the humanitarian crisis that is occurring right now in the Gaza Strip. John Elmer, a Canadian journalist who spent considerable time in the occupied territories and who frequently writes about Israel and Palestine and is the editor of FromOccupiedPalestine.org, asked another spirited question as to why the IDF targets Palestinian children, at least 1,900 of whom have died within the past 6 years, and why Israel dropped thousands of cluster bombs in the last 48 hours on its attack on Lebanon. To which the general replied, "I am not aware of those figures," meaning that the IDF has never killed Palestinian children, and also that the IDF targets city centers because that's where the terrorists live, you know, with their mothers, brothers, and sisters. Quite insidiously, he said that Palestinian children don't fight with rocks, but in fact are strapped with bombs. So, to sum up this exercise in free speech and tolerance for death squad leaders, the general insisted that, quote, "I cannot lie, it is a fact, and it is a war of peace." Tian Jasmine reporting from the Twilight Zone at UBC.
This week was What is Women Week at UBC. Radio Free UBC talks with Rin and Dali of the Feminist Collective.
Rin, what is Women Week?
Well, ever since there's been a feminist collective in the AMS, which started way back in the 70s, there's been a week dedicated to talking about gender and talking about feminism. And so we're just honoring the story in the past of organizing around gender issues on campus and recognizing that we're still facing a lot of the issues that people were facing back in the 70s, like trying to get equal treatment from the university, trying to get, you know, respectful treatment from people in power. You know, recognizing that the feminization of poverty still affects differentially how people access services and access education on campus. And also recognizing that there's still a need to talk openly and respectfully about our bodies and our identities and our sexuality and being comfortable being in the bodies that we're in and feeling like gender is something that we can celebrate and sexuality is something we can celebrate instead of it being secret, being shameful, and being oppressed by it.
What are some of the events that you guys did throughout the week?
Well, we started out showing a film on Monday, which was talking about gender representation in advertising and media, and it was really interesting, brought up a lot of issues about representation and gender and how gender roles get perpetuated and how gender roles become prescriptive and how that affects people's lives, and that was really interesting. And we've been trying to celebrate our gender and our bodies and our sexuality. We held a breast casting event, making plaster breast casts, which was always really fun. And we've been working on feminist cheerleading, so keep your eyes open for some good old-fashioned feminist rabble-rousing on campus pretty soon, thanks to the feminist cheerleaders. And Thursday night we had a coffee house where there were some performers. We had music and poetry. It was really wonderful, just trying to celebrate cultural change around gender and talking about gender and how it affects us and bringing it out of the secret silent places and celebrating it and talking about it in honest ways. And that was really awesome. And then also today we had a forum talking about how we can build a climate that prevents gendered violence and violence in general from happening on campus. And so that's sort of the week has culminated in having a really positive conversation with members of the community around how we can build an anti-violence climate instead of a climate of silence on campus. So that's been really positive.
What are some of the difficulties that you guys face doing feminist organizing on campus?
Well, I think there's still a lot of hostility to the word feminism because people don't really know what it means. So I think as a collective, what we try to do is talk about feminism as a way of liberating everyone from having other people tell you who you are. We're just trying to build a culture where everyone gets to decide for themselves who they want to be. And instead of gender being something external that defines people, we're trying to foster a culture where everyone celebrates themselves as they are and supports everyone else to celebrate themselves as they are. So
have there been special difficulties in the last week, especially during the Why Does Women Week, in doing organizing?
Well, we had an ongoing struggle as the feminist collective and also the entire female student body at UBC in coping with the Women's Center being vandalized and creating a positive and active response that isn't silenced. And so the Feminist Collective held a forum this week in addressing the concerns of female students and creating a positive response to the misogynist and homophobic vandalism that we received in the Women's Center, and creating a direct response in denouncing this kind of behavior.
And now Radio Free UBC's Mariana talks with Marianne Bobinski, Dean of the Faculty of Law at UBC.
Many people out there that think racism is a thing of the past, but consider the following. In Canada, immigrants experience disproportionate amounts of poverty and are often found working in the most unstable, undesirable, underpaid, and unsafe jobs. It is estimated that over 500 Aboriginal women have gone missing, mostly from Western provinces, in the past 15 years, and very little has been done about it. This Wednesday morning, two men of South Asian descent in their 70s were assaulted by a group of teenagers during their morning walk in Surrey. Similarly, on Sunday, a bus carrying farm workers was heading down 132nd Street in Surrey when it was pelted with rocks thrown from a nearby car by a group of young white men. Here at UBC, a 2006 report from the Equity Office shows that only 15% of instructors self-identify as visible minorities and only 1.23% as Aboriginal. It is evident that racism is still prevalent in our communities. A recent example comes from the UBC Faculty of Law. Recently, a newsletter was distributed over email to all the students in the faculty. This newsletter which producers claim to be satirical, is full of racist, sexist, and homophobic messages, which have deeply offended many members of our campus community. Many students have expressed concerns that these messages are coming from not just any students, but law students who in the future will be in high positions of power as lawyers, judges, policymakers, and politicians. Marianne Bobinski, Dean of the Faculty of Law, quickly responded to this incident by releasing a statement condemning the publications and reassuring the community that the faculty is committed to diversity, mutual respect, and creating a safe learning environment. Similarly, the UBC Law Student Society passed a resolution and issued a statement condemning the publication. Aboriginal students and students of color in the Faculty of Law have also spoken up about this issue. Radio Free UBC had an interview with Marianne Bobinski, Dean of the Faculty of Law. Can you describe the response of the Faculty of Law to the recent occurrences on campus?
Part of our response has also been to try and use this situation as one where we could recommit ourselves to the values of being in an academic environment where issues, even controversial issues, can be discussed, but where those discussions occur in an atmosphere of mutual respect and an atmosphere where students, no matter what their background, feel welcomed and included in the academic environment. And so we've had town hall meetings and meetings with individual students and groups of students all around that question of how to be a place that fosters open, free debate about matters of any type while also creating a safe space for our students.
And would you consider that issues of racism or even more broadly sexism, homophobia are prevalent in the faculty?
Well, I think one of the things that's made this particular situation so controversial is that the people who sent the publication had expressed the view that they were attempting to be satirical and, in fact, to criticize the law school's commitment to First Nations issues, and that the language that they chose was intended to, in fact, be critical of people who are racist. Certainly, large numbers of students and people outside the faculty who read the publication had very strong reactions of pain and distress at receiving the publications, but I think it's part of what has made the issue so controversial is that the law school as a whole has had to grapple with what's the significance of intent in a circumstance where so many people feel injured by the words that were used.
Mm-hmm. What kind of protection is being provided to those students that do speak up against the harassment that they are continuously receiving?
The general question of how to create an environment that's a safe one for the students who've spoken up to explain their pain and distress upon reading the first email is one that we are working on as a community, and there are student initiatives and faculty-supported initiatives to essentially try and make sure that the faculty takes the existence of these newsletters and uses the pain and agony and the hurt created by them as a motivation to improve the safety for the students in our school. And so it's a very difficult thing, and it's a very painful thing for the students who've had to experience this. But the hope of the administration, certainly, and the people who've been attending town hall meetings and who've been attending meetings on these topics is to work together to make sure that this remains a safe environment. There was another edition of the SPAM publication today, and although I've had preliminary discussions with people about it, I've not yet had a chance to talk with some of the people who might feel most deeply affected by it, which I certainly intend to do, and I know that we as a law school community will be prepared to stand with those individuals and to help them feel safe to express their concerns about racism, sexism, homophobia, or any other kind of discrimination in the law school environment.
And that's all for Radio Free UBC. Don't forget to catch Noel Aid on October 25th in Trek Park. We'll see you next week.
And thanks to Radio Free UBC for that piece. And now with a look at other local news, here are Hannah Kim, Tracy Fuller, and Carrie Baptist.
Attorney General Wally Opal has confirmed Christopher Paul Neal is under investigation here in BC. Powell says the RCMP has received several claims from residents of Metro Vancouver saying they were abused by Neil, but no charges have been laid. Well, Powell says the police investigation in this country is active and has been going on for some time. The 32-year-old Maple Ridge man is now in custody for Thailand. Custody in Thailand following an international manhunt in connection with the alleged sexual abuse of boys in Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam.
According to a study released this week, Burnaby's Metrotown SkyTrain station is bursting at the seams and requires more than $25 million in upgrades. The study was sponsored by the City of Burnaby, TransLink, and the federal government. In demand are wider walkways and a longer platform. Improved access for cyclists, pedestrians, and wheelchairs are also needed. City Councillor and Burnaby Transportation Committee member Sav Dhaliwal says he doesn't think the station handles the volume of people who use it safely. 40,000 people cross the station's walkway every day. Plans include extending the platform to increase capacity and replacing or improving the overhead walkway to make it wheelchair-friendly. Public washrooms, a new bus loop, and a possible second overhead walkway are also being considered. TransLink expects to fund the project with some potential help from the city and province. Burnaby City Council will consider the plans next week.
Sponsorship cash for the 2010 Olympics is rolling in. The Vancouver Olympic Organizing Committee has released its annual report showing sponsorship money has exceeded the 2007 target by at least $15 million. The report reveals VanOck has raised $80 million in sponsorships to the end of the fiscal year, which translates to 88% of its total target of $760 million. Still to come in 2007 is the unveiling of the 2010 mascot, completion of several venues, and the delivery of the 2010 competition schedule to the International Olympic Committee's Executive Board.
Vancouver men involved in dolphin slave trade scandal. Former Vancouver Aquarium dolphin trainer Chris Porter is accused of shipping live dolphins from his private education center in the Solomon Islands to Dubai at a price of $30,000 per dolphin. Two plane loads of dolphins have been shipped in this manner, and recently dead dolphins have been discovered near pens used for the transfer. Porter has been defended by officials in the Solomon Islands as a human wildlife expert intent on boosting the country's economic prospects. The international organization that regulates the global trade of endangered plants and animals, CITES, said this week it had no reason to stop the shipment and no proof that Porter's company was harming dolphin populations in the islands.
The City of Vancouver says police will evict a group of tent city squatters who are protesting the lack of affordable housing in the city. Zach Badorf files this report for our friends at Free Speech Radio News.
By City of Vancouver employees will likely come to an end this weekend after just under 3 months on the picket lines. Zach Badorf reports from British Columbia.
The Vancouver Public Library Workers Union has not yet signed the agreement, but a vote is expected today, bringing an end to the union's first strike in its 77-year history. The deal comes less than a week after the striking garbage collection workers successfully finished their negotiations with the city. They resumed services earlier this week, cleaning up months of trash piled up around the province's largest city. 78% of the library workers voted down on mediators' recommendations last week because they said it didn't fairly address pay equity amongst the mostly female staff. The tentative agreement they'll vote on today reportedly has only minor modifications to the original deal. But with now 87 days on the picket line, some of the workers are feeling the effects of the strike in their pocketbooks. Union representatives attended a nationwide union convention in Toronto Wednesday to ask for donations to sustain the workers in case they opt to continue their fight. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Badorf in Vancouver.
And thanks to Free Speech Radio News for making that piece available to us for rebroadcast. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned to CITR for more news following these public service announcements.
Courtney, can I get an interview with you?
No, I hate your guts, Nardwar. You're such an idiot. Why would I give you an interview? You're an idiot. Why would I give you a f***ing interview? Get what?
Oh!
CITR 101.9 FM presents Nardwar the Human Serviette Radio Show, 20-hour, 20-year anniversary interview marathon. 9 p.m. Thursday, November 1st, on to 5 p.m. Friday, November 2nd.
Nardwar will be celebrating the 20th anniversary of his radio show on CITR with a 20-hour live on-air Nardwar interview marathon, starting at 9 p.m. on Thursday, November 1st, and ending at 5 p.m. on Friday, November 2nd.
Interviews to be aired during the 24-hour marathon include
Robert Anton Wilson, Ron Jeremy,
James Brown,
John Crossell,
Angela Robinson,
Zach
Grafler, Bill Dewey,
Tommy Lee,
Nine
p.m. Thursday, November 1st to 5 p.m. Friday, November 2nd. Nardwar the Human Serviette Radio Show's 20-hour, 20-year anniversary interview marathon, presented by CITR 101.9 FM.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:21. Now with a look at other BC news, we're joined in studio by News 101 reporters Tracy Fuller, Carrie Baptist, and Hannah Kim.
Border crossing into the U.S. are busier than ever thanks to the strong Canadian dollar, but BC residents hoping for a quick trip across the line will have to keep something in mind. Construction begins November 5th on a project at the Blaine border crossing that is likely to cause severe congestion for drivers traveling back into BC. The $70 million upgrade to the Peace Arch station will restrict traffic flows northbound for approximately 2 years. The Blaine crossing is the third busiest along the entire U.S. border.
Environmental groups, including Greenpeace and the Living Ocean Society, say they will pay for an underwater inspection of wreckage lying at the bottom of Robson Bight off northeastern Vancouver Island. The groups say the probe will begin October 30th and $40,000 has been raised to pay for a manned submersible to check the potentially fuel-laden wreckage, which sits 350 meters below the surface. In August, a barge listed and accidentally dumped several pieces of logging equipment, including a tanker carrying 10,000 liters of diesel fuel, into Robson Bight. The area is a protected killer whale habitat famed for its whale-rubbing beaches.
Transportation Minister Kevin Falcon says he will meet with the president of BC Ferries and the head of the Ferry Workers Union next week to discuss marijuana use by crew members. Falcon says they'll try to come up with a plan to take to the federal transport minister to make whatever changes are necessary to ensure public safety. But he says he's not ready to back a call by company president David Han for mandatory random drug and alcohol testing. The issue came up after the Transportation Safety Board reported widespread pot use by crew members on BC Ferries' northern routes. However, there is no evidence to suggest crew members on the Queen of the North were high when the ship sank.
If you want to contribute your 2 cents worth to BC's upcoming budget, now's the time to act. The chair of the Select Standing Committee on Finance says the deadline has been extended until the end of next week to allow for more written, online, or flyer submissions. MLA Bill Bennett says online submissions are down considerably compared to last year, and he says it's an important way to gather input from rural residents. The committee has been holding hearings around the province in advance of the 2008 provincial budget due in the new year.
A houseboat that flipped on Okanagan Lake 2 years ago was rocking while still tied up at the dock, according to a witness who testified at the trial of the boat's skipper. Randy Mayer was on board the Quintana Roo as it was about to depart on the night of June 8, 2005. He told the BC Supreme Court in Kelowna that the houseboat was overcrowded and unstable before it set off on a party cruise to celebrate a friend's birthday. The boat flipped over about 50 meters offshore, drowning 20-year-old Camille Fry in the bathroom. The boat's captain, Benjamin Broadwith, is charged with criminal negligence causing death and dangerous operation of a vessel causing death. We're going to take another break now, but when we come back, we'll update you on national and international news. Stay with us. News 101 will continue right after this.
On Sunday, October 28th, 2007, at 3 p.m., Kokoro Dance will present Heart, Mind, Spirit, and Soul.
Critically acclaimed Kokoro dance combines kinetic and visual elements from Japan and the West to create a uniquely Canadian Butoh aesthetic. The company has produced over 900 performances and created more than 150 dance works that have been performed across Canada, in the United States, and in Europe. With Carolyn Chen and Holly Holt, this concert is presented as the second in our Sunday series of three dance and music performances entitled Stimulating the Senses, Music and Movement at MOA. That's Kokoro Dance performing Heart, Mind, Spirit, and Soul on Sunday, October 28th at 3 p.m. For more information, please visit www.moa.ubc.ca.
Five 26, and the news continues on CITR. Joining us in studio with more on what's happening in Canada and the world, here are News 101 reporters once again, Carrie Baptist, Hannah Kim, and Tracy Fuller.
Canada's largest union has committed itself to a $5 million national campaign aimed at fighting privatization. The Canadian Union of Public Employees approved the strategic initiative today, which aims to bolster public services, or at least stop their erosion. The Strategic Directions Program calls for a combination of strikes, demonstrations, lobbying, and political campaigns to achieve the goal of fighting off privatization in sectors such as healthcare, childcare, social services, and education. The program says privatization and contracting out are a direct attack on equality that has a disproportionate impact on visible minorities. CUPE also wants to establish collective bargaining targets based on a minimum wage of $15 an hour.
Defense Minister Peter MacKay insists a new offshore revenue deal between Nova Scotia and Ottawa is firm, despite concerns there is no signed document. MacKay says Ottawa is committed to introducing legislation that would guarantee Nova Scotia will not lose royalties under changes made to the federal equalization formula. The most recent budget sparked a fight between the governments because it had forced Nova Scotia and Newfoundland to choose either their existing offshore deals or an enriched equalization formula. Some critics have wondered why there isn't a formal agreement, but MacKay says details are contained in letters between the two governments, and legislation will soon be tabled in Parliament. Nova Scotia Premier Rodney MacDonald also has confidence Ottawa will honor last week's agreement.
Turning to MacKay's own portfolio of national defense, the minister says an opinion poll of Afghans measuring support for the NATO-led mission in the country is a sign of democracy, is a sign that democracy is taking hold. The Environics research poll is based on nearly 1,600 interviews with Afghan men and women. 60% of the respondents have said the presence of foreigners in the country is a good thing, while only 16% said it's bad. Support is weaker in Kandahar, where Canadians have been engaged in bloody battles with the Taliban, although most respondents still want the foreign soldiers to stay. While Canada has a high profile when respondents were asked which foreign countries are involved in Afghanistan, virtually no respondents could name Canada when asked which countries are fighting the Taliban.
Environmental groups are accusing the federal Tories of being dishonest over the Kyoto Accord. Environmental Minister John Baird says Canada will not formally withdraw from the climate change agreement, despite this week's throne speech saying the targets cannot be met. Baird says the government will pursue its own strategy for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The environmental groups say if the Tories had the strength of their convictions, they would drop out of the treaty altogether.
Hudson's Bay Company says it's going to cut prices on targeted items at its seller's discount department stores thanks to savings from the high dollar. The rise of the loonie above parity with the U.S. greenback has given the retailer more room to negotiate with importers for goods sold in their stores. Consumers, meanwhile, continue to complain they have yet to see the higher currency gains reflected in lower prices of everything from cars and computers to TVs. The loonie is closed today well above $1.03 American.
And in international news, California is the first state in the U.S. to ban products designed for children and babies that contain a large quantity of phthalates. Sorry if I butchered the pronunciation of that. These are a type of chemicals that are used to soften plastics and are found in toys, cosmetics, paint, pesticides, shampoos, and other items. The bill was signed into law last Sunday and will take effect in 2009. It states that products sold in California must contain less than 0.1% of the phthalates. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says that the chemicals threaten the lives of young children in their developmental years. The bill was opposed by the American Chemistry Council. The council says that the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission found that the toys containing the phthalates are safe. Here in Canada, Health Canada has acknowledged that there are some concerns with the chemical, but say current levels found in products do not pose a serious threat to consumers. Health Canada has stated that exposure to large amounts of phthalates has been shown to affect the liver and kidneys and cause reproductive or birth defects and suspended disruption of the endocrine system in laboratory animals. Despite these findings, the government says that there isn't enough evidence to indicate that exposure to phthalates poses a risk to human health. Phthalates are among the 69 known contaminants that Statistics Canada is testing for in 5,000 Canadians as part of a comprehensive survey announced last year. It's time now for another break here on News 101, but stay tuned for commentary and much more coming up on the other side.
Are you tired of not hearing live music bands or hearing really bad ones playing at local hotspots?
Head out to Shindig, a music pleasure event presented by CITR 101.9 Vancouver Radio.
It's the hottest band event of the year, with a hand-picked fresh variety of music for your tired little ears.
The event will be held every Tuesday until December 4th at the Railway Club, located at 579 Dunsmuir Street on the corner at Seymour. Show starts at 9:30 p.m. God Chosen bands playing this week include
Fanshawe, The Noble Fuzz, and The Public or the Press.
Bring your own band sporting t-shirts.
Some of our sponsors include the Railway Club, Buckville Studios, Moot Records, Scratch Records, The Hive Recording Studios, Backline Musician Services, Zulu Records, CITR, Thunderbird Radio Hell, Discorder, Canadian Music Week, Vader Metal.
Welcome back to News 101. It's now time for commentary, and this week, Phil takes a look at the future of union negotiations in BC and how now that library workers are back at work.
As reported widely throughout major news outlets in Vancouver, it seems that Vancouver's librarians have struck a tentative deal with the city. This deal would send the last of Vancouver's strikers back to the job, effectively ending what has been dubbed as Sam's Strike. Living in a traditionally union-heavy province, strikes are commonplace, and the term essential service is considered hearsay. Unions know how to push their weight around. They have typically been able to dictate the terms when negotiating with the government and maintaining high levels of public support. Their strikes have nothing to do with improving services for the taxpayer, but rather ensuring job security, pay hikes, and pension benefits. With these priorities, I'm surprised these union members aren't running for public office. And these priorities are the result of worthy goals of the past degenerating. Unions once were at the forefront of promoting safe working conditions and reasonable working hours for their members. However, times have changed. Union goals can be summarized as less for more, fewer services for a higher cost. In the last year, many contracts expired between the government and unions across the province. Many were able to settle before striking. Due to BC's hot economy, the BC Liberal government could afford to spend greater amounts of slush money blindly. But things don't always stay the same. The economy evolves, and so does society. The impact of globalization has been unprecedented in affecting labor distribution globally. Many jobs in manufacturing and the service sectors have been outsourced to markets that provide cheaper labor, the scope of which many do not realize. The next time you're going through a fast food drive-thru, remind yourself that you're giving your orders probably to someone in India. Companies are constantly finding new ways to improve their profit margins. For labor they can't outsource, many immigrants have taken unglorified work as a springboard to social mobility. This brings me back to unions. Unions are effectively sheltering themselves from outsourcing and external competition. If someone would like to work as a garbage worker or a librarian, they must join the union. Effectively, they must fall in lockstep to their mandate. However, the unions can run from globalization, but they cannot hide. The impact and the direction globalization is taking in our society, unions will have no choice but to adapt drastically once public opinion inevitably becomes to vote with their pocketbook. People know when they see a group of people sheltering themselves from the negatives in society, yet enjoying all the benefits. We see this a lot with elites. In the case of elites, people feel that the system is made for them, and there is nothing they can do to change. But in the case of unions, people can demand that the government take action, and sooner or later, union members will play on an equal playing field with the rest of us. For News 101 Commentary, I'm Phil Cottery.
And thanks for that, Phil. Our producer, Megan Turcato, is here now with a look at our oddity of the week, about a woman whose expression of her affection just went a little too far.
Thanks, Katie. This past Tuesday, a woman in Avignon, France, went on trial for kissing an all-white painting by artist C. Tremblay. Rindy Sam was charged with voluntarily damaging a work of art after her lipstick left an indelible stain on the canvas. Art restoration specialists have tried to remove this smudge with nearly 30 different products, but the work of art, with an estimated value of almost $3 million, remains marred. Sam defended her actions, telling the court the kiss was a poorly thought-out act of love, not a crime. She maintains that she thought a fellow artist, Twombly, would have understood. Prosecutors, on the other hand, want Sam to pay a $6,500 fine and take a class on good citizenship. The verdict remains out.
Wow. I don't know. You think that is just, you know, common sense. If you were in the Louvre and you were looking at a glorious piece of art, sure, you can admire it from afar, but there are certain levels of decorum and how you behave around art.
You shouldn't let your passion out of control for the art.
Obviously, this woman just loved it too much. I mean, this kind of, I don't know, it's all about manners. I mean, you enjoy the arts, Megan. Like, you know, if you go to a play, you're not going to wear jeans to the Queen Elizabeth Theatre, or, you know, some people just don't know the
value of good art.
I guess they
don't. No respect.
Where did you find this, anyways? Don't
the
know.
Oddity section of CFN.
Oh, well, it's very creative. Well, no pun intended, even though it's about art. But anyways, thank you very much for that lovely oddity, Megan, and we'll see you on Monday.
Great.
All right, it's break time again, but coming up next, it's the Arts Report with Katie Fitzpatrick. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Who are you?
Who are you?
I'm Nardwar the Human Serviette. And everybody probably already knows that, right?
Man, you are out of it. You really are out of it.
Oh, right. Thanks much, Timothy Leary. And
welcome to my castle. Welcome to my castle.
On November 2nd at 7:19 p.m. at the Sub Ballroom, come celebrate Nardwar the Human Serviette's 20th anniversary at a free all-ages anniversary gig with his band, The Evaporators.
For those who like to drink, there'll be a beer garden set up separately from the show.
Also playing will be local power pop sensations The Transmitters, the dual female blast of the Pack AD, and the tasty accordion stylings of Kid Cordine.
That's the Sub Ballroom, 6138 Sub Boulevard on the UBC campus, November 2nd at 7:19 p.m. sharp. Come and get evaporated.
CITR podcast update. Number 5.
Work has begun on Canada's Information Highway. That's the state-of-the-art network that we're told will change everything from the way we do business to the way we learn. As it comes more and more into our personal lives, how are we going to cope with the techno-peasants? I mean, this world, which was a fantasy for me 10 years ago, every 6 months becomes more a part of my own real life. You know, in the place where I do most of my writing, I now I'm just hooked into the world electronically,
right,
or
yeah.
Would be if I could figure out how to make the bleep modem work. But I'm technologically over my head already. The limit on me is not what you can do, it's what I can do.
I'm not sure you want to use your bleep modem, or any modem for that matter, with receiving podcasts. But, you know, just check out our website and I'm sure you'll figure it out.
For more information, visit CITR.ca/podcast. Thank you for listening, and please be kind to robots.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
And welcome back to News 101 on CITR. I'm Katie Comley coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. Right now, it's 5:39, and time to turn things over to Katie Fitzpatrick for a look at the arts.
Hello, I'm Katie Fitzpatrick. Welcome to your 5-Minute Art Spot. So to start off with some listings, Gus Van Sant's first feature, Malanoche, is having a return at Pacific Cinematheque this weekend, and it's going to be on restored and remastered 35mm print. So if you're a film lover, this might be something you want to check out. Saturday, 9:35, Sunday, 7:30, and Wednesday, 9:35. Another interesting one in film is a documentary opening tonight at Cinemark Tinseltown, and that's called My Kid Could Paint That, and it's about a 4-year-old abstract expressionist painting prodigy. So sort of an interesting look at the state of art nowadays. In theater, there's Death and Taxes. That's October 18th to 20th at 7:30 p.m. at the Dorothy Somerset Studio Theater, and that's on University Boulevard here at UBC. Tripsichore Yoga Theater. Yoga's answer to Cirque du Soleil combines advanced yoga and dance. That's October 23rd at 8 p.m. at the Croatian Cultural Center. The Glass Menagerie. The Arts Club presents Tennessee Williams' semi-autobiographical portrait of a faded Southern belle and her 2 grown children. That's October 25th to November 25th at the Stanley Industrial Alliance Stage. I'm going to be checking that one out in the coming weeks, and I'll have a review on Arts Express. The GOAT. Catherine Shaw directs Jay Brazeau, Susan Ristic, Kevin McNulty, and David Hurwitz in Edward Albee's comedy about a husband and his extramarital relationship with the GOAT. That's October 25th to November 10th at 8 p.m. at the Presentation House Theater, and I'm also going to be checking that one out soon. His Greatness. The Arts Club Theater Company presents the premiere of Daniel MacGyver's play inspired by an early 1980s Vancouver visit by Tennessee Williams. That runs till November 7th. It's at the Granville Island Stage. I had a chance to check it out a couple days ago, and you can hear the review on Tuesday the 23rd. In dance this week, there's the 2007 Vancouver Open Dance Sport Championship. As many as 300 couples will compete at professional, pro-am, and amateur levels in standard Latin rhythm and smooth programs. That's October 20th to 21st at the Vancouver Convention and Exhibition Center at 999 Canada Place. Iza Bobo, Nigerian-born Comfort Arrow, presents dance, drama, and songs from Africa. That's October 24th to 28th at the Scotiabank Dance Center. Also in music, there's Dastan Ensemble and Salar Agili. Performers from Iran perform classical Persian music. That's tonight at 8 p.m. at the Centennial Theatre in North Vancouver. Northern Light. Guest conductor Chifuro Matsubara leads the Vancouver Chamber Choir in a concert of music from Japan, Canada, and Scandinavia. That's also tonight at 8 p.m. at the Ryerson United Church on West 45th. In comedy, the Trailer Park Boys are appearing at Yuck Yucks tonight at 8 p.m. And finally, in literary events, the big news is, of course, the Vancouver International Writers and Readers Festival. The 20th Annual Literary Fest features events with more than 85 authors from around Canada and the world. That goes till October 21st at Granville Island. And you can find more information at www.writersfest.bc.ca. Finally, a few upcoming events. There's the live performance art Biennial. The fifth edition of Canada's largest performance art festival features 18 days of events featuring local, national, and international artists, including Raquel De La Loya from the Philippines, Glyn Davies Marshall from the UK, and Tanya Mars from Toronto. That goes until October 28th at various venues, and you can find information at www.livebiennial.ca. Also, another interesting event is the Downtown East Side Heart of the City Festival. The fourth annual event features 12 days of music, theater, film, hip-hop, drumming, readings, comedy, poetry, visual art exhibits, workshops, and history walks, with a spotlight on Asian-Canadian artists at the Downtown East Side. That's October 24th to November 4th at various venues on the Downtown East Side. You can find more information at www.heartofthecity.festival.com. Finally, one more thing to announce in theater. There's The American Pilot. Mentors Project presents the Canadian premiere of David Gregg's satire about an American pilot who crash lands in a hostile country. That runs till November 3rd at the Jericho Arts Center, and I'm mentioning this because I'm seeing it on Saturday, and you can also hear a review of it on the episode of the Arts Express on the 23rd. Now next up we have a review of Hannah's Suitcase by arts volunteer Tracy Fuller.
The Canadian play Hannah's Suitcase, written by Emile Scherr and based on the award-winning book by Karen Levine, is being presented at the Green Thumb Theatre and the Norman Rothstein Theatre this week. The play follows Fumiko Ishioka, the curator of Tokyo's Holocaust Museum, and her 2 children, Akira and Maiko, as they cross continents and cultures to discover the history behind Hannah Brady's empty suitcase. Arriving from the Auschwitz Theater in Poland, the mysterious suitcase of the unknown orphan girl ignites the curiosity of the 2 children and leads them down a path of discovery, learning about the injustices and the inhumanity of the Holocaust, but inspiring and empowering the children to believe that hope for a peaceful future is possible if they remember and learn from their past. The play offers a combination of flashbacks and real-time scenes coupled with photos, tableaus, and soundscape. Educating young people is paramount to the production, and although the play is aimed at a younger audience, the story's themes and message resound for all those in the audience. Toronto actress Jessica Greenberg has been in the play since its conception, playing the integral role of Hannah Brady. Following the production's Vancouver premiere, she had this to say about the play's impact.
It's a very special thing, and it's rare that projects like this come along that you can feel so connected to and feel like it's such an important story to tell, and it's amazing to be able to see how it impacts people so profoundly, and it impacts children so profoundly, and for many children, it's their first experience learning about the Holocaust. You know, for some, I'm Jewish myself, so growing up, I always was taught about the Holocaust. But for many children, that's not the case. For many children, they walk into the theater, and this is the first they've heard. For, you know, depending on where we're traveling in the country, for some children, they don't know any Jewish people, and it's a brand new experience. So that's a tremendous responsibility, bringing that story to them. But I feel very fortunate.
The play will run until October 28th at the Norman Rothstein Theater, located at 950 West 1st Avenue. For ticket information, you can call the theater box office at 604-257-5111.
And thanks to Katie for that. We're just going to regress back a little bit and give you some more international news. Meher Arar, the Canadian victim of United States' extraordinary rendition, testified yesterday to Congress via video link from Ottawa. For the story, here once again is FSRN.
For the first time, the Canadian victim of the U.S.'s secret extraordinary rendition program testified before Congress. Today, Meher Arar gave insight into the U.S.'s controversial CIA-run program that covertly sends alleged terrorism suspects to countries that attend the hearing in person because the U.S. has banned him from entering the country. Instead, he spoke to lawmakers through video conference. His gripping testimony expresses details.
By then, it was becoming more and more clear to me that I was being sent to Syria for the purpose of being tortured. I was put on a private jet and flown to Jordan, then driven to Syria, and eventually ended up at the Palestine branch of the Syrian military intelligence on October 9th. There I was put in a dark underground cell that was more like a grave. It was 3 feet wide, 6 feet deep, and 7 feet high. Life in that cell was hell. I spent 10 months and 10 days in that grave. During the early days of my detention, I was interrogated and physically tortured. I was beaten with an electrical cable and threatened with a metal chair, the tire, and electric shocks. I was forced to falsely confess that I had been to Afghanistan. When I was not being beaten, I was put in a waiting room so that I could hear the screams of other prisoners. The cries of the women still haunt me the most. Over the next 10 months, the only time I left my cell was to be interrogated or for meetings with the Canadian consul.
Arar has been speaking out since his detention by U.S. officials 4 years ago. A Canadian of Syrian descent, Arar was sent to Syria, where he was tortured and secretly held for nearly a year for an alleged connection to terrorist organizations. He was released because of lack of evidence. Representative William Della Hunt of the Foreign Affairs Committee.
So, Mr. Arar, let me personally give you what our government has not, an apology. Let me apologize to you and to the Canadian people for our government's role in this mistake.
Legislation is pending in Congress that would require the State Department to compile a list of countries that authorize torture and then prohibit the U.S. from sending any detainees there.
Thanks to FSRN and once again for making that speech available to us for rebroadcast. And in breaking news, we're taking this from CBC British Columbia, a two-person aircraft has crashed into the ninth floor of a building in Richmond, BC. A two-person aircraft that took off from YVR this afternoon crashed into the ninth floor of an apartment building on a busy street in Richmond, BC, reportedly injuring two elderly people. There is no report on the nature of their injuries, but the pair do need medical attention. The building was immediately evacuated after the plane hit, says a spokesperson for the Richmond RCMP.
The plane, which was heading towards Pitt Meadows and is believed to be a Cessna-sized aircraft, crashed at a very high speed. One witness, who was a worker at the Canadian Line Project on No. 3 Road, said that the plane was about 250 feet high when it came down. Susanna Da Silva of CBC News was at the site and described the scene as chaotic. She said there's no smoke or fire coming out of the ninth floor balcony. As at least a dozen ambulances and police cars are on the scene, which is on Saba Road near No. 3 Road. The area is home to a number of high-rise buildings in the central area of the suburban city. An RCMP spokeswoman says the cause of the crash is being investigated. And to get back on track, we're going to go to Thunderbird Eye on Sports with Tyler Noble.
And thank you, Katie. The UBC men's hockey team is back in action at home this weekend, hosting the Regina Cougars for a two-game set. The Thunderbirds are off to a fantastic 3-1 start to the season, having swept the Alberta Golden Bears at home 2 weeks ago and leaving Lethbridge last weekend with a split. The Cougars enter this weekend's series without a win on the season, but UBC head coach Milan Dragicevic says that doesn't mean they should be taken lightly.
They play a very defensive style, and they wait for you to make a mistake, and then they pounce on you. They have big forwards. They have some really good puck-moving defensemen. I know that their Achilles heel this year has been scoring goals, but every game, as you see, they're only a goal away or, you know, a lucky bounce away from winning the game. So they're obviously going to try to make a statement this weekend by trying to win their first game.
Both UBC goaltenders Jerry Festa and Francois Thuot have been stellar in net so far, with Dragicevic saying he'll ride the hot keeper. Thuot will get the start in net tonight, with puck drop for both games set for 7:30 at the Winter Sports Center, and both can be heard live right here on CITR. The UBC men's basketball team closed out their preseason play this afternoon as they hosted the Toronto Varsity Blues at War Memorial Gym. CITR's Wilson Wong was there and has this report.
The UBC Thunderbirds got to see the two extremes of what could happen this coming season. Looking like a team without a leader or any sort of direction, they were down 23-6 before the end of the first quarter. But after a tongue-lashing from head coach Kevin Hansen at the half, UBC came out red-hot in the second, and they were led by Chris Dick, the player everyone hopes will be the team's next great offensive star. He scored 17 in a third quarter that saw the Thunderbirds turn a 12-point deficit into a one-point lead.
I just wanted to do it on the floor, and we just came together and just started playing again. I think we were all kind of a little nervous at the beginning, and no one was really playing, and we were all kind of hesitant. Second half, we just took it and like it was ours.
The second half scoreline proves that statement. UBC outscored Toronto 51-28 to come out with an 85-74 win. They finished the preseason with three wins and a loss. The Thunderbirds' next game is their Canada West Conference opener at home Thursday against Trinity Western. Wilson Wong, CITR Sports.
The women's basketball team, meanwhile, closes out their preseason this weekend with a pair of games against McMaster and the University of New Brunswick. The Ladybirds dropped their first exhibition match of the year in a 69-42 loss to the Arkansas Lady Razorbacks in early September, but have since won four in a row and hope to close out the preseason on a high note. This weekend will be UBC head coach Deb Huban's last chance to see her players in action before finalizing the Birds roster, which has a notable hole to fill since the graduation of All-Star post Kelsey Blair. The Thunderbirds open their regular season next Thursday night at home against the Trinity Western Spartans, a game you can hear live right here on CITR. Tonight's exhibition game against the McMaster Marauders goes at 6 p.m. at War Memorial Gym, while tomorrow's tilt with New Brunswick also goes at 6 o'clock. Following their 26-14 defeat to the Manitoba Bisons last week, the UBC football team has a bye week before heading out to Calgary to face the Dinos on the 26th. The week of rest is much needed for a banged-up Birds team, who's hoping to have the services of first-string quarterback Doug Goldsby back after missing the last 4 weeks with a shoulder injury. The Birds currently hold the fourth and final playoff spot in the Canada West with a record of 3-4. Calgary sits 2 points back but can tie the Birds in the standings with a win against the Simon Fraser Clan tomorrow. Manitoba, Regina, and Saskatchewan have already secured trips to the postseason, but UBC will need to beat the Dinos next week to take the last spot up for grabs. And of course, we'll have next Friday's big game right here on CITR beginning at 6 o'clock. The second-place UBC women's soccer team is back at home this weekend, hosting Regina and Manitoba for a pair of weekend games at Thunderbird Stadium. The Ladybirds face the Cougars tomorrow afternoon at 2, but it's Sunday's match against the first-place Bisons that has all the attention. UBC lost their number one ranking with a loss to the Lethbridge Pronghorns last week, and a win against the Bisons can get them back into a tie for first place in the Canada West. The Birds beat Manitoba 4-1 in their second game of the season, and since then the Bisons have lost only once, never letting in more than two goals in a game. UBC head coach Mike Mosier says Manitoba's strikers are as good as any in the league, but as long as the Thunderbirds don't have any defensive lapses, they shouldn't be in any trouble. Kickoff for Sunday's match is also at 2 p.m. at Thunderbird Stadium. The men's soccer team is also back in action this weekend as they visit the Trinity Western Spartans tonight and then head right back out to the Valley to face the Fraser Valley Cascades tomorrow. The third-place Thunderbirds are coming off a scoreless draw against Lethbridge last weekend and with a pair of wins have the opportunity to move into sole possession of second place in the Canada West. The dominant Spartans boast a 9-point first-place lead over Alberta and have scored an impressive 24 goals in 10 games. Needless to say, UBC's defense will be kept busy and will have to rely on scoring help from Charles Valliers and rookie midfielder Jorge Engalmira, who leads the Birds with 4 goals. Kickoff for tonight's game against the Spartans goes at 7 p.m. out in Langley, while tomorrow's match in Abbotsford is set for 3 o'clock. The first-place women's field hockey team hosts the Alberta Pandas for a two-game series this weekend to close out the regular season. And with just a tie, the Lady Birds can clinch top spot in the Canada West heading into the playoffs. The Pandas gave UBC their only loss of the season with a 2-1 upset in the season opener. Alberta will need their offensive guns going if they want to pull out a win, as UBC's defense has allowed less than a goal against per game on average. Both games are held at UBC's Wright Field, with tomorrow's match beginning at 2, while Sunday has a 1 p.m. start. Fresh off their victory in Thunderball last weekend, the men's volleyball team is in Honolulu this weekend, taking on the University of Hawaii for a two-game weekend series to close out their preseason tune-up. The Birds open conference play in the Canada West next weekend as host to the Winnipeg Westmen at War Memorial Gym. We'll have that match, as well as the women's game with Winnipeg, in a webcast next Friday night on CITR.ca. And that's Thunderbird Eye on Sports. Katie, back to you.
Thanks, Tyler. And before we go tonight, we're going to check in with our meteorologist, Selena Ferris, for a look at your weekend weather. Selena?
Well, I've got some bad news. This stormy weather isn't over just yet. The current low-pressure system sitting over us and the one coming in off the coast will make for a wet weekend. Saturday, expect rain all morning, easing to scattered showers in the afternoon. Sunday, we'll see some periods of rain throughout the day. Temperatures will be in the low teens, and winds will be high all weekend long. Look for a break from the storms by midweek. That's your weekend weather, brought to you by the Storm Club at UBC. For more information, you can email us at stormubc@gmail.com. Back to you, Katie.
Wow, so it looks like even though it's, you know, been raining miserable all week, we're not going to see any relief this weekend.
No, we're not. It might be a quick break in the clouds Saturday afternoon, but I wouldn't plan on going outside for very long for that.
Oh, or you have to get out your rubber boots and make sure you're prepared for the weather, right?
Yeah, and your umbrella.
Yeah, exactly. I know I've seen a lot of people around with full-out rain gear, lots of brand-new Lululemon raincoats gracing the UBC campus. So it's that time of year, 'tis the season, I guess, right?
That's the way to do it.
Okay, well, thanks, Selena, and we'll see you on Monday. And that's our program for October 19th, 2007. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Megan Tricotto produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Katie Comley. Thanks for listening. Coming up next, a solid hour of quality independent radio on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.